Take a network break. Welcome to our weekly dose of context, analysis, and informed cynicism. We've got a red, white, and blue virtual donut and a piping hot cup of patriotism for you for the 4th of July holiday. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is my co-host Greg Farrow. Let us jump right into the news. Cisco announced that customers can run, quote, the network OS of their choice on their Nexus 9200 and 9300 switches. That announcement came in a blog post from David Goeckeler, who's a senior VP and general manager of the networking and security biz at Cisco.
I thought the sky was falling on my head.
It was a surprise. And it wasn't at the top of the post. It was kind of buried in the middle. Like, they don't want to make a big deal out of it. They're kind of sliding it in there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. If they didn't want to sort of talk about it, why did they make a blog post on their internet thing?
Right.
Which, you know, like, it's kind of like, on one hand, I think I've got something to say. On the other hand, I'm trying to hide the lead, which is, you know, maybe that's it, just buried the lead, and that's what it is.
They completely buried the lead.
Yeah, so reading between the lines here, so what Cisco's actually done here is disaggregated two models of Nexus 9000 running the cloud-scale ASICs. And what they've done is released a SAI, which is a switch abstraction interface, which is an open compute project, so that people running other operating systems could run them on these switches, on these Nexus cloud-scale capable switches. This is not iOS runs on anything else. It's the reverse. It's you can buy a hardware and run your operating system, but sort of implicit in the statement was only certain people can have them.
The blog was also in the context of a partnership with Microsoft. And we know Microsoft has its own Sonic network operating system. They use that to run their Azure infrastructure. And so It wasn't stated in this blog, but there was a report from SDX Central, which we'll have a link to, that said it's probably going to be Sonic that Microsoft is using on top of these Cisco switches.
Yeah, it seems possible. So I imagine if I was Cisco, I'm very keen to get into the cloud providers somehow because they've been frozen out of all of them at this point of view. And really, Microsoft is the only one that's talking to the legacy IT vendors. But if you recall, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about HP's financial results and they had a massive drop in server sales because a tier one provider
that
stopped buying their products.
Right.
So it seems highly possible that this is not something that they want to continue with, take a risk about, because remember, Cisco, like HPE, is not a growth company and investors are not there for a wild and bumpy ride up and down. Cisco is a dividend company. And in fact, this week they announced that they are going to be, their revenue will steadily decrease over the next several quarters. So investors get ready for that as they make the shift from selling hardware to selling subscription revenue. So remember, we talked about in last week's show about the DNA, the digital network architecture with intent-based networking, will only sell with subscription licensing for the software. So that means Cisco has to defer a lot of revenue, which in the long term, if they can maintain market share, obviously means that they'll earn more, because they have told investors that subscription revenue means they will make more money than ever before in the longer term. So this sort of thing is where Cisco can sell some hardware only to HPE with the cloud scale ASICs, because there's something in there that...
To Microsoft, not to HPE, to Microsoft.
Yeah, that's right, to Microsoft. If they can do that, then I think the game here is that Cisco needs to get volumes of these cloud scale ASICs up. The people who want to buy these versions of the Nexus, they charge a little bit extra because they're not merchant silicon and they're generally associated with the tetration and the specific features in ACI. And so they're like an added value switch. There's no signs that Cisco is replacing its Broadcom Nexus 9000s with these yet, but they need to get the volumes up to make it, like in silicon, you need lots and lots of volume to make manufacturing these chips cheap.
Sure. And when you call it cloud scale, it seems like you're going to go after the cloud providers with it. And so you do what Microsoft says.
You know, you fake it till you make it. You know, you pretend it's got a feature hard enough and maybe it's actually got the feature. I don't know. But that's nothing new. That's what everybody does.
Sure. That's part of the business relationship, yes.
You know, I think for Cisco, there's a couple of things here. Obviously, they want to sell some hardware. They want to stay in touch with Microsoft. They want to sell them routers as well as, you know, all sorts of things. And so if they could sell them a couple of 10,000 or 20,000 of these cloud scale ASICs, that would boost their volumes and bring down prices on the other products. So if you can bring down the prices on your stuff you're selling to enterprise, you can take more profits. So that's probably where I think they're headed there. But this isn't what most people would want, which is Cisco's iOS on a white box. It's definitely the reverse. It's you can have our hardware and run your operating system, but it's pretty limited. So I think they're really speaking to investors and saying our hardware has an in to the cloud companies. We're not dead yet.
That's right. And I have a note into a Cisco contact person to get more detailed. What operating systems are they talking about? Is it a variety? Is it one-off? Is it a special deal? I haven't gotten any response yet. If I get word, maybe I'll put up a blog post or something. But we've got word out to get more details. And as that comes out, we'll let you know.
Yeah, I can't see Cisco giving this away to the enterprise, because that would mean people could replace that NXOS software on these switches and run an open. Like if you were running ACI or you bought these switches to do something and you decided that Cisco wants to keep charging you for software and you could now got an out. You can go and get third-party software that could keep you going while you decide not to pay Cisco for the software. That doesn't seem strategically like something Cisco would want to do. I think Cisco wants to sort of say, well, we've got you by the short and curlies paying subscription fees. You don't have an out, so you have to pay it or replace the switch completely. And I think that sort of brinkmanship, or sales brinkmanship, is something that Cisco does very well. So I would expect that to be the way forward, not to give customers an out, especially in the enterprise.
All right, moving on. Nutanix, they held their annual conference last week, and the main story coming out is the company's ambitions to become the software glue that's going to knit together your premises workloads and the public cloud. So they announced a new service called Z Cloud Services, which the way I'm reading it, it sounds a little bit similar to vCloud Air, essentially a duplicate Nutanix environment managed by Nutanix Prism software that you deploy into a public cloud. And they're talking about a disaster recovery service as being the first use case for something like Z.
Well, Nutanix has to do something with this cloud capability in the same way that I've been saying for a while. You know, we've been talking about it for a while, that the big vendors have to come up with something that operates like public cloud. And you should literally click a button and the VM is installed, you know, and all the networking and the storage and the servers and the blah, blah, blahs are just all invisibly provisioned for day-to-day purposes. So this is completely obvious. I'm sure Nutanix has been working on this for some years, because it's the obvious progression of their platform. You know, once they had the software-defined storage running, and now they're partnered with a whole range of hardware partners, like they're doing a partnership with Plexi to use Plexi networking in some of their stacks. Plexi's been making lots of noise about that. So the obvious thing is that if you want to stop your customers defecting to, you know, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and so forth, then you want to have something that looks a lot like that. And so Nutanix is already very software-centric and can move in that direction. So no surprise, I guess.
That's right. They also announced a strategic partnership with Google around hybrid cloud for workloads that could run in Nutanix on your premises and in Google Cloud Platform. Again, here Nutanix software would be, quote unquote, the control plane to manage applications between your premises and GCP.
Now, that's the surprising part, right?
What surprises you about that?
Well, the thing is, Nutanix obviously wants to sell its hardware. It's always been very big about, we sell our hardware and you put our software on top, because that makes money. And if you're a startup, you need the revenue coming through the door. So this moving to be just a software company and saying, well, you can use Nutanix to manage your Google compute or your AWS or whatever it is, that's actually a change. They're saying you can keep your private cloud and you can use us as a hybrid cloud or a multi-cloud management play.
Mm-hmm. I think it's smart of them, because they're competing against folks like HPE and Dell EMC and even Cisco with UCS that can run on and survive on thin hardware margins. Nutanix as a startup can't. And so taking that software angle and being the glue that can actually, if they can actually pull off creating a real easy, fluid, hybrid private public cloud environment, that's going to be big for them, I think.
Yeah, well, talking with several people at Cisco Live this week, the answer is private clouds are going to be first, and then everybody believes that enterprise is going to be multi-cloud. So they're not going to be just AWS. They're going to be Azure and something. It would be most enterprises, right? They're going to have something in one cloud and something in another. So it makes sense if you can land and expand. So if you can land in the enterprise with a Nutanix, and then as they expand into the cloud, you can grow with your customer, is what they'd call it. I'd call it trap your customer into your product line. But, you know, so two sides of the same
potato
coin.
Potato, potato.
Yeah, come see, come sir. But it does make sense if you're already managing all of your infrastructure inside of Nutanix on a private cloud type, you know, VMs and blah, blah, blahs. Then all of a sudden you can start, if you move a couple of things out into the public cloud, well, you might use your Nutanix to orchestrate those, and that might offer you a pathway forward. And I mean, we've seen VMware do their VMware on AWS, for example.
Right. Right? It's a similar attempt, yes. Except with VMware pricing, which doesn't help.
Yes. So, you know, that's in that direction as well. VMware is gradually getting its management platform to reach into the private clouds one way or the other. One way is to actually go and put its services in the public cloud data centers. But there you go. Yeah.
Yes.
And then use NSX to weld them together. So that gives you the connectivity play. Nutanix isn't doing networking here. They're just doing service orchestration, I think.
To me, this reads as Nutanix long-term saying, we're not going to tie our fortunes to hardware sales. We recognize that, yes, we can get a lot of revenue if you buy, you know, Nutanix hardware all integrated, but down the road, we see that we need to be software and we need to be flexible. And so this is a realization that other enterprise vendors have taken a long time to get to, like a Cisco. Nutanix seems to be getting there much quicker.
Yeah, I would think so. But then Nutanix is smaller and can move faster and it's got no legacy to protect.
Sure, of course.
There's different points of legacy revenue, whereas Cisco doesn't want to encourage customers to leave their private clouds and get into the public cloud and then too much, because if they did that, they might stop buying routers and switches and they might shut their branches down and, you know, stop buying stuff in the data center. So I think Nutanix is taking advantage of, and Nutanix is very much a software company that uses hardware for revenues, a lot like ACI has demonstrated. We're really a software play, but we sell hardware just to keep make the numbers up.
That's right.
It would be better off if it was just running on any available switch instead of relying on custom features, I think. But in this case, yeah, again, companies have different purposes. I think Nutanix has got little to lose here.
That's right. All right, we'll keep track of that as it goes. Another story, AT&T, they published a blog called Scaling White Box, and it calls on the telco providers and server providers to, quote, take more responsibility for the technologies powering their networks. I thought that was interesting because it's essentially planting a flag saying, we need to be responsible for our own fortunes. That means we're going to drive white box. We're going to, and it's a message to OEMs and traditional vendors that the nature of their relationship with them is changing.
Yeah. And I think this is about the customer taking control of the vendors. So up until now, many customers have passively accepted what the vendors give them and then made it fit. And I think AT&T, and we've also seen Verizon, a range of other carriers, and many very large enterprises are now pushing the vendors into shapes they don't want to be in. You know, we've talked about this a lot. AT&T is definitely going down the white box path to save money, I think in part, but also to get flexibility and speed. So specifically here, they're saying the existing OEM suppliers can participate in this new ecosystem. Smart OEMs recognize this trend and are ready to be part of it.
That's right.
Some have already started by disaggregating their existing solutions and by providing pieces into this new white box ecosystem. In other words, hint, hint, you know, dig in the ribs. I was talking off the record to somebody this week, and he was saying that they have had problems with their existing suppliers to the point where they now have what they call a multi-provider strategy, which is code for no more from my legacy supplier. So, you know, I do think there is a real sense of desire for change. Now, whether this will actually turn into real change is something that will yet to be seen. So, you know, customers flexing their muscles and saying, you know, we're using white box to beat the vendors into submission. But AT&T has a very powerful strategy here. They're laying out exactly what they're doing, and they've been very consistent about it and persistent about it.
They have, yes.
In terms of, yeah. So they're saying here, you know, like they talk specifically about brands like Metaswitch and IP Infusion and SnapRoute. That paragraph where they basically call out, it's time for you to participate. You know, don't try and keep selling us the mainframe. We need something different.
Yep.
It's a real call to action. And I think this would worry the vendors more perhaps than anything else. It's not white box that worries the vendors. It's when customers start dictating how they want the vendors to sell their products. And then vendors lose control of their revenue and their product cycles, right? And their product roadmaps. Because if customers start saying, this is what we want, and they can buy it from wherever, then the vendors lose control of the customer. And that is what enterprise IT relies on, or certainly what most IT vendors expect, is they expect to dictate to customers what to buy and how much they can charge for that. So this could really drive a wedge into the sales cycle.
It could. And AT&T has been not only consistent in this, they've also been very public about it, which I think is kind of unusual for a big telco or service provider. They tend to keep their business to themselves. AT&T in particular have been very active and public about what they're up to in this whole white box and disaggregation and rethinking how this all comes together space.
Yeah, we do see headlines occasionally around Verizon doing stuff as well. And maybe it's just because I'm not seeing it. So
it could be possible. It could be that others are talking about it, yes.
It could be just that I happen to be able to be tracking the AT&T white box because I'm subscribed to some information. But, you know, who knows? I mean, we have seen articles coming out from SDX Central about, you know, Verizon open source white box coming soon. Our vice president said at a conference a few weeks back. Now, we talked about this. This was in May. We did actually talk about this because we wanted to flag the fact that AT&T has been very – and then we said Verizon has – now starting to talk more publicly about theirs. But, you know, it could be just that we're not seeing it. So, yeah.
Right. One more thing I wanted to call out that jumped out at me in reading this blog, which we'll link to in the show notes. quote, service providers should be comfortable with their technical teams being deeply involved in the design details of the end solution, which to me kind of echoes a point that you've brought up several times, is that organizations have to make a choice between sort of investing in technology versus investing in people. And we've been short staffing or short shrifting the people side for a long time. This to me seems more like an indication that, hey, there's value in having the right staff, well-trained staff, to get involved in their hands dirty in the design and deployment of these technologies. And I was encouraged by that.
Yeah, again, same vein. I think that, you know, AT&T has a fairly crystal clear direction about where it's going. Now, keep in mind that AT&T is a big company. It's got many business units. It's not a super tanker. It's a bunch of rowboats. And just because one rowboat is making noises and sending up flares doesn't mean every other part of the fleet is doing the same thing. So let's just wait and see how this executes. I'm trying not to over-rotate on these things.
All right, I'll tamp down my enthusiasm.
Yeah, like it's possible, but we'll see, you know.
All right, Microsoft, they've announced they're acquiring a startup called Cloudyne that helps companies track their cloud costs and monitor cloud usage. It integrates with the big three, that's AWS, Azure, and Google. And Microsoft was already actually a partner with Cloudyne. The acquisition price wasn't disclosed, but there's an article in Seeking Alpha that puts it about $50 to $70 million, which is pocket change for Microsoft.
Yeah, so this is obviously part of wrapping up your portfolio. Customers really feel that sense of lack of control around cost, and it's quite opaque. You don't know how much you're going to use. You don't know. And enterprises are used to being saying, you know, this is my budget. This is my thing. This is what's happening. Bang, bang, bang. And so if you can't help customers understand their costs and predict their costs, then you have a bit of a problem. So Microsoft is acquiring this. Now, just to show you that this is not a surprise, remember that just a few weeks ago, HPE acquired a company called Cloud Cruiser, which is also a cloud cost management platform.
That's right, they did.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show. So I think this is just, you know, that's the same thing. As we've always seen, customers need to have visibility and transparency into pricing. I know so many people have done stuff on AWS and gone, this is just costing me a fortune, and I had no idea how much it was going to cost me. So, yeah.
That's right, not to mention orphan projects that get started up and running and then sort of left behind and are just costing you pennies every hour, but that adds up over time. These kind of visibility and cross-control tools, I think, would be very popular and useful. I'm not surprised that Microsoft is there.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, again, customers need to know what they're buying, how buying, and be able to predict forward what their bill's going to be, because IT doesn't have the ability to, they get a fixed budget every year, and you need to know how you're going to spend it. And so having cost tools like this that have been pre-developed means Microsoft doesn't have to develop themselves. So this sounds like an acqui-hire. You're getting yourself a product, and now you can throw some more resources onto it and put something together that'll give customers what they're asking for, some certainty and predictability around price. Yeah.
And certainly it could be useful to say, hey, look at how much Azure costs versus these other competitors and do some kind of value calculations there. And I'm sure Microsoft wants to come out on the better end of that cost calculation.
I would think so. I don't think they'd fudge the numbers because...
No, that's not what I'm saying. But if you want to, we're getting into a world where folks have a lot of choice. And so any kind of comparison can be useful.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. But I don't think it's a comparison thing. I think it's literally customers need to feel that they're in control and that they can predict how much money they're spending. Especially, you know, if you're moving up to, let's say you've got a $5 million IT budget and you move on to Ada, onto Azure, and then you just don't know how much you're going to spend. Is $5 million enough?
Right.
You know, how much are you going to spend with Azure? 500,000, 700,000, a million? You've got no idea. So,
right.
Yeah.
And the bill could be different month to month. And yeah.
Yeah. So you need these tools to help you predict and to get that accurate. Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Greg, you and I and Ethan actually got a briefing from a company called Path Solutions. They've announced they're adding a natural language query and response capability to their network performance management software. So the idea is you can type in a question using common language like, hey, what happened between New York and San Francisco at 3:30? And then you get a natural language response.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the Path Solutions product is fine. It's a standard sort of a network management tool that you can use for root cause troubleshooting. We've seen plenty of these over the year. It seems to be a perfectly acceptable product. This feels gimmicky to me, like, you know, questions in natural language, which is, you know, I guess if they're doing root cause troubleshooting, if there's a problem at a certain time, you know, like if you're saying to the thing, there's a problem between such and such and such and such, and it suddenly tells you something, then I'm a little bit equivocal about that because most people in IT are pretty smart and they know how to talk to computers. So I'm not 100% sure of the value of this.
Well, there's also they're adding an integration with Amazon Echo, so you can actually talk to the system and get a voice response back, which I agree, when I first heard about it, seemed a little gimmicky. The more I think about it, I think, you know, it could be cool. And if it's useful to some degree, great. More people are interacting with computers via voice, so why not give it a try?
Yeah. Now, that's just a total gimmick, right? So, that's the sort of thing like, you know, saying your switches were designed by the same people who designed Ferrari cars, which we had a lot of fun poking at last week because, you know, as if that's important or valuable to customers in the real world, I really don't feel that's a thing. So, and the fact is that an Amazon Echo isn't as great because you actually have to speak exactly the words that it's set up to think. So the way an Echo works is that you have to specify the exact word, and when you match those exact words, your Amazon Echo will then transfer them into an action, right? And so it's up to the developer to code in the exact word patterns. All you're relying on the Amazon Echo to do is to recognize words. And then you say, which words will it understand? So it doesn't actually work all that well for that sort of thing. You know, but maybe feeding it into a natural language engine will get you something further. But I think nobody wants an Amazon Echo in their enterprise ops help desk type thing to help them debug. I think that's pretty silly, honestly. I mean, I bet you it looks good at a show, though.
I'm sure it does.
It's one of those things you put it on your stand and everybody will gather around and think that's really cool. And then later on realize how silly it is. Yeah.
All right, moving on. Speaking of companies that are having their switches designed by Ferrari, you were at Cisco Live last week. You've got some notes on just sort of your general takeaways from the whole event.
Yeah, well, seeing as I spent the whole week there and some of the thing I wasn't able to keep up with all the news, I thought we should talk a little bit about Cisco Live. A few things worth noting. Obviously, we were there as part of the Apstra event that we had, which was well attended. And with Cisco announcing intent-based networking last week, and again, thank you very much for announcing that before the show. That was great. But Apstra was very popular, obviously, because people wanted to see the Cisco solution and then have a comparison. And so the Apstra booth was well attended. And they've got a really good product, really interesting product, which I think has, and the differences are clear, I think, for people who want to get into it. But I watched the keynote on the first day when Chuck Robbins got up on stage. He's definitely improved his speaking. If you watched his keynote from Cisco Live last year, he looked really uncomfortable and wasn't impressive. You know, obviously, stepping into the shoes that John Chambers did, is that he was quite an exciting speaker. So,
yeah, say what you will about John Chambers, he was a dynamic speaker.
Yeah, a little repetitive, but, you know, used to talk about the same things year in, year out. But he was a good speaker, really passionate, really committed. He didn't really announce anything during the keynote. Nothing was highlighted. There's nothing really stood out. I think I put a tweet out during the week that he talked, one of the things that he talked about, which he just mentioned in a quick sentence in passing, but instantly grabbed my attention because it's a bugbear of mine, is talks about reducing complexity. So that really hooked me. Obviously, Tim Cook coming on stage got everybody's attention. There's not too many companies who can get Tim Cook to fly down to Las Vegas from Silicon Valley.
No.
They didn't sort of say much. Like, they sort of said, yeah, we're buddies and we're working on stuff together and we really like each other. But they didn't sort of, you know, announce any features or functions. They're saying the cooperation between Cisco and Apple is coming and it's going to be great.
We've talked about some integrations they've had around their UC capabilities and Apple mobile devices. So it does seem like there's some real things there. Certainly bringing the king of Apple onto stage, you know, as a power play, it's a power move saying, look how influential and important we are.
Yeah. And I think the execution, I mean, one of the things about these keynotes, I mean, I'm going to have a grumble about conferences in general, but, but if you're going to put a mediocre speaker on stage, don't glam it up, because they really went Vegas out. They went to Vegas on him and, you know, lights and amazing sound and blah, blah, blahs. And of course, when somebody who's not a great speaker gets on stage right after, and I've seen the same thing with Alcatel, you know, we saw the Nokia announcement last week was the same. And then all of a sudden somebody goes out and starts droning on. It's just like, it makes it worse.
Yeah. Sure.
Don't try and pretend there's something exciting. And, you know, it's like, and you're expecting Prince to rock up on stage and hammer out the first chords of, you know,
Purple Rain.
And all of a sudden it's like, I'm Chuck Robbins. It's not, you know, the dichotomy, you know, the contrast is stark when that happens. I think they make a mistake by, you know, and it's almost as if, yeah, anyway, I just sort of thing.
Some free advice to conference organizers.
Yeah, I just feel that there's like this, you know, ever-ending thing to make these enterprise IT conferences ever more glamorous and ever more lights and ever more rock and roll and, you know, it's as if to get the energy up in the room. And and then somebody drops a damp rag in the middle of the stage. It's just not, you know, the contrast really stands out when you do that, because you get all excited. And, you know, you've been in keynotes. You get the music and the lights, and everybody's, you know, shuttled in and sitting down, and, you know, blah blah blah, and then you go, oh, that was. That makes the lows worse, I think.
It does. The contrast can be jarring. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So the conference was, of course, well-organized. Cisco Live is always a very well-organized conference. This year it was spread out over multiple buildings, which was painful. There were a lot of people had to go over from one building quite substantially across the road to get to where the testing center was, and that was annoying for a lot of people. It took a lot of time to get around, so that was a bit of a pain.
I saw a lot of tweets about people boasting how many steps they were getting on their step counters.
Yes, I can tell you how much my legs and back hurt right now, but we won't. But interestingly, the executive track. So Cisco Live always has an executive track. It was actually separated from the main conference. It was actually held in an entirely other building. So it was three buildings, I think. And that was weird, because I'm used to seeing the suits all power walking around the place and a horde of Cisco sales reps making sure they don't actually see anything they shouldn't. So maybe they just took them all off into a special roped off area so they couldn't escape or something like that. Make sure they don't have any independent thoughts all of their own. So that sort of took some of the life out of it. The show floor was smaller and less interesting than in previous years. It took me a long time to sort of think about why it would shrink, and then it sort of twigged when several vendors told me that they weren't allowed to exhibit at Cisco Live because Cisco doesn't want to see its competitors there. And then, of course, well, the obvious thing is why, and then you figure it out, and you say, well, Cisco's moving into those adjacent markets. You've got the unified comms, you've got the UCS, you know, you've got the vertical stacks where before the hyperconverged plays and converged plays that Cisco's got going on. And as companies like Dell EMC merged, they weren't there. So EMC would have always been at a Cisco conference, but not anywhere to be seen. So no Dell EMC. VMware was there, of course, but NSX was definitely not. So I thought maybe the show floor has been a bit dull overall because there wasn't any sort of diversity. It was all, you know, marching to the Cisco beat. So that made it a little dull. I felt that the lack of the people from the Middle East was notable. So I suspect that the travel bans that have been put in place have sort of restricted people. I know that a lot of people I met from the Middle East in previous conferences said that Cisco Live in the US was always perceived to be the premium conference, the best one of them, and that they would always go to that because that's where they wanted to get access to all the information. And I suspect that changes in travel rules have made it very difficult for people from the Middle East to go. And I wouldn't blame them in the least. To be
for
fair.
Not coming, yeah. Hmm?
Yeah, so I felt that maybe the attendance was down and perhaps in part because of that in that work. But, you know, I could easily be wrong. I wouldn't like to make, as I said, the buildings, it was very, very spread out. And so it was very difficult to make an assessment. So, yeah, and just one sort of grumble completely was that I felt there was also just a lot of silliness around the place. Like there's a lot of games and a lot of stands doing fun things, right? You know, so you can take crazy photos and post them on social media and all that sort of stuff. And I was just thinking to myself, I wonder what, you know, IT executives back in the head office would think if they see this social media spewing out all this fun stuff, and they'd be thinking, like, is this really a place for serious business, or is this just a holiday camp for nerds?
I was actually thinking the exact same thing as I watched my Twitter feed over the few days, and I actually tweeted that we may have reached peak social media because the ratio of tweets about socks and Legos to actual product news was about 100 to 1, I thought. The degree of silliness was, I mean, yeah, great, have some fun and enjoy yourself, but it did not seem like serious business was happening. And it's not just Cisco. I've noticed that happening at a lot of different vendor events. There's, you know, dress like a superhero or have this 360-degree action camera take you doing some dynamic pose and we'll shoot a glitter cannon at you. And, you know, here's games and here's magicians and put on a funny hat. And it just gets a little much.
Yeah. And there was prizes for people for who did the most tweets.
Right. Right.
You know, some of the top tweets were accounts that had been created for Cisco Live and just spat out rubbish all day. And all it did was clutter up the timeline. I couldn't see anything that was worth. Right. So I just think there's this over-rotation on social media, and, you know, the only way you can have – the way you can get some high numbers on your social media engagement is just to tweet rubbish and, you know, incentivize people to tweet rubbish, and all of a sudden your numbers look good.
I think if I was an artificial intelligence program and you asked me what Cisco did, I would say they made Lego minifigures based on my Twitter feed.
Yes, or they're superheroes.
Right, I mean, that's the most... right. They fight crime. They make Legos and fight crime.
And that was the most, I felt that was really condescending. You know, like, you're a superhero. Oh, please. I go to work in technology. I'm not a superhero. I'm a nerd, you know. It's like, I felt it was really, I just, So maybe I take myself too seriously, but it did feel insulting to be told that I'm a superhero every 10 minutes. And then, you know, just goes on and on. I mean, you know, can't we just have some grown up themes and, you know, act like adults instead of like a bunch of high school students? Or maybe it's just me. Tell me it's just me. Email me, right? Packetpushes@gmail.com and tell me I'm being a grump or a
grumpy Greg.
But I did feel like, you know, I take my business seriously, right? Lighthearted in places, but seriously. And a bunch of kids running around acting like high school students didn't really project an image that I think I want networking to be seen as, and enterprise IT more generally. And encouraging that is, I think, bad for the people who run those conferences, you know, the vendors who run those conferences, and we should need to do reconsider is my view.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you, I think.
And as you say, it's not just Cisco.
No, it's not. It's all the big ones. The silliness level, I think, has tipped over into too much. We can have some fun. We don't have to be all buttoned up, but we do need to get some things done too.
Exactly.
All right, rant over. We're going to talk about security for a minute. Of course, the big news last week was another ransomware attack from the Petya malware, leveraging existing weaknesses in Microsoft Windows that should or could have been patched but weren't, and the exploits taking advantage of that, also based on tools and malware and a vulnerability that was stolen from the NSA. Greg, what's your feelings?
Well, what drove this was there was a link threat post posted that Anthem, which was a company that was breached back in 2015, they're going to pay up $115 million for whatever.
Are they a healthcare provider, right, or a health insurance company?
That's right, yep. So they're paying up $115 million to somebody because they got breached. And I've always made the point that security doesn't matter because the cost of a breach doesn't actually cause you any problems. But Petya is changing the game here. So what we're seeing is these WannaCrys and these new forms of attack, which are actually taking your machines and then breaking them. So it's actually straight up destruction. Petya looks to be an attack, a cyber attack, like a cyber warfare attack, actually. It started in the Ukraine, where somebody took over an accounting company's software distribution server and inserted the malware into it. And once it got in, it was then downloaded in the Ukraine, this was. And this Ukrainian accounting company was then downloaded, of course, by all of the accounting companies just ahead of their end of financial year. So it was calculated to have maximum impact on the Ukrainian government. And once it's gotten out, it seems to have gotten out of control. I suspect that it was meant to be restricted to the Ukraine, but it absolutely went global. We've seen some very large companies taken down, like Maersk Shipping, which is a very large shipping company.
Yeah, one of the largest shipping companies in the world.
Yes, and they run something like 18% of the ports as well as the ships. So they run in ships and ports, and most of those are offline as we speak. They still haven't been fixed.
Yeah, I think a couple of ports in the U.S. actually had to be closed down while they got systems back online.
Yeah, so the way it works is these are based on WannaCry and NSA vulnerabilities. So it uses the Eternal Blue and the Eternal Romance vulnerabilities that came from the NSA that were in the Shadow Brokers and WikiLeaks put it out there. And so it's actually very based on SMBV1, and it uses a couple of known vectors. But once it gets into your system, if you've got any sort of legacy Microsoft infrastructure, which, you know, really Microsoft should have done better by now, but once it's in there, it actually starts to use legitimate Windows tools to escalate. So once you get the thing in there, it gets onto a machine via this, it escalates, gets privileged rights, and then it can laterally move around the system using legitimate tools. So it's very difficult to kill once it's inside your network. Once your machine's compromised, it would appear that decryption is not possible. Don't pay it asks you to drop Bitcoins into a thing. Basically, no one's ever going to be able to collect those Bitcoins because people are going to be monitoring. Bitcoin transactions in the modern era are easily trackable by state-level organizations. Yeah. And the email address where you send your request to has already been killed off by the German company that was hosting that. So links to all of this is in the show notes. I've done quite a bit of research in this and talked about it. Probably the best one, it comes out of Cisco's Talos group, which is their security intelligence team. They had a good blog post on it, but there's a bunch of others from McAfee and Fortune talking about the Maersk thing if you want to find out more about it. The point here is we're seeing a shift in security away from data leaks or data breaches where somebody steals your customer information and then sells it on the open internet to monetize. This is straight out destructive hacking. So what people are doing is creating malware that just goes and destroys machines. This changes the game for security, and I take back what I said where it was just cheaper to be breached. This is really destructive to companies. So don't worry. I wouldn't be too worried about exfiltration. Nobody seems to suffer any serious financial results for that. What you need to stop is penetration and lateral movement from damaging malware like this. And so that's the security you should be focusing on. So don't worry so much about proxy servers and data leakage. What you need to be protecting against is this stuff. And ultimately, that's just patching and upgrading to the latest versions of code.
Okay. Interesting, though, to get you to change your position on security spending. And is it worth it?
Yeah, well, the trick here, of course, is it's not about firewalls.
No. It's about your standard information security and risk management hygiene, essentially.
Yeah, and micro-segmentation. So the interesting thing here is that if you could prevent lateral movement, you could restrict the damage that would it had, of course. So some sort of cyber warfare tools or cyber criminals, this sort of destruction, if you had network segmentation, micro-segmentation, like what Cisco's talking about in its intent-based digital network architecture, they want to do micro-segmentation in the campus using overlays that's similar to what NSX is doing in the data center. That's exactly what you need in this case. So there are network strategies emerging to handle this, and you might want to start looking at how to break down your campus and protect lateral movement and restrict communication between branches in your network and things like that. SD-WAN, of course, can do that. That's the sort of thing that you should be looking at. Don't rush out and buy malware detection tools or proxy servers or firewalls. They won't help you. What you need is network micro-segmentation to get through this, in my view.
All right. There's a recommendation. Okay. Our last story for this episode, Open Daylight, that's the open source SDN software platform. They released Carbon. That's the latest update in their release. We got a briefing on it. They announced some new features, but I think the general gist was stability, maturity, adding new use cases, kind of moving on business as usual.
Yeah, well, now that OpenStack and the enterprises have sort of stopped looking at open source, and the vendors in particular have been giving open source a good kicking lately. I wonder why.
Yeah.
really, what I should be saying is, here's the challenge: ask yourself why. So, what Open Daylight Carbon is clustering and federation is one key thing. So, they're working on the HA features of Open Daylight. And they called out in particular just how big some of the deployments of Open Daylight is in China, and highlighted that some very large cloud companies over there use Open Daylight to orchestrate all of their networks.
Mm-hmm.
So just because people in this part of the world aren't using Open Daylight doesn't mean other people aren't. And apparently these are big, big companies like Tencent and Alibaba.
Yeah, they also mentioned that you, in fact, might be using Open Daylight and just not know it because some vendors and integrators are putting it under the covers and it's in software and being used in services. You just may not be aware of it.
In particular, optical companies, I've noticed, they're packaging up Open Daylight with their own orchestration platform on it. And this release, particularly the press release from Open Daylight, the link is in the show notes, of course, highlights the current focus for work. As an open source project, it reflects those people who are participating. And the people who are participating is the telco companies who are focusing on network functions virtualization management, especially related to IoT, metro Ethernet, and cable operator needs.
No surprise.
As I've always maintained about Open Daylight and OpenStack, it's going to go from here into the carriers who are going to use it for something, and then we'll probably see it reflect back to us as it comes out of that process, matured, stabilized, focused on specific use cases, and then we can adapt that back to the enterprise as time goes by. Forget what vendors are saying. They don't like it because they can't work out how to monetize it within 2 quarters. And I think Open Daylight and OpenStack is just going to be like most Linux projects. They take 5 to 10 years of gradual, consistent, grinding effort as they work towards where they want to be. Linux didn't appear inside of 2 or 3 years. It took much longer. So just keep your eye out on that thing and put it into your 10-year strategy to keep an eye on. Open Daylight and OpenStack is mine.
Absolutely. Don't write it off. You know, OpenStack and OpenDaylight both came out with a lot of hype and then sort of went quiet. That's because they're actually, as you said, grinding out the work, doing it, making it stable, making it mature. Yeah. So don't write it off. Keep it on your calendar. Keep it on your horizon. It's a good project and there's interesting work being done. And we'll have links if you want to find out more.
Yes. We try and back up what we talk about on the show in the links so that you can do the same research and then disagree with me. We'd love to hear from you.
Just send us email. Or yes, tweet us a picture.
Mm-hmm. It'd be fun.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Greg, where can folks get more from you if they want to get outraged?
You can find me on LinkedIn using my real name, Greg Farrow. And you can find me on the Twitter, is at Ethereal Mind. I do occasionally eject random microblogs at etherealmind.com and longer form, more interesting content, of course, at packetpushers.net.
And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packofpushers.net. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes, because that really helps. Share a link with your friends and check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packofpushers.net. And if you're interested, we've got a Pack of Pushers Slack channel that you're welcome to join. Just send, send Greg or packofpushers.net an email, and we'll sign you up. Thanks for listening.